Now the topic of this shir is how a Beis Din will use the concept of Dina de Malchus. It's in a sense almost like a continuation of what Rabbi Willig was speaking about, but specifically in terms of the Beis Din itself, when they will employ Dina de Malchus Dina in their own, within the halachic framework. So we're not talking about individuals who are going to a non-Jewish court, to Arkos. We're talking about two Balei Din who are coming to a Beis Din, and they're following Torah law. When the Beis Din will, within its deliberations as Torah law, use Dina de Malchus Dina as part of that, as part of their deliberations, as a factor in coming to decisions. Now, there's one aspect of this that is purely practical, and that's not what we're going into. I believe that there's actually another session that's going on right now that's talking about confirming arbitration in court. And that is, so there's the idea that a Beis Din, if they want to make sure that their arbitration can be confirmed in court, they have to make sure to follow legal procedure, proper legal procedure. For example, making sure that there are no ex parte communications, even though according to halacha, sometimes that might in certain circumstances be warranted, but you know that would automatically ensure that the arbitration would be thrown out in secular court. So there are certain, obviously, if a Beis Din is going to be prudent, they're going to follow Dina de Malchusa in terms of the proper procedure to make sure that the decision could be confirmed. There was one case I read about years ago where an arbitration decision was vacated, was thrown out because they met on Sunday. And you can't just, Sunday is not a, if you meet on Sunday, you have to sign a waiver in order for it to be enforceable in court. And the Beis Din of America has those waivers. Those are generally used. So that's not what we're talking about, because that's purely practical considerations. So what we're talking about is in terms of halacha, when Dina de Malchus Dina is applicable, when it is somewhat in conflict with halacha. And the first source that we'll look at is the one that looks like this, the Bar Ilan looking printout. It is from the Bar Ilan program. Number one, where it says Beis Yosef Choshen Mishpat Simen Chavav, and the Beis Yosef over here is quoting the Rashba, and there are two formulations. You see Kosav Rashba, and then again lower down where the sort of the next paragraph begins again Kosav Rashba B'tshuva. So these are two different tshuvas of the Rashba that deal with a similar idea. Now let's see the case that the Rashba was discussing. Look at the top part of it. Shenishal al echad shemesa bito. Certain men, Nebuch, his daughter, who had been married, passed away. V'tava es chasano ba'arkos hagoyim sheyachzir lo kol hanedunya. He took his son-in-law to court, to non-Jewish court, that the nedunya, the dowry, should be returned. Sha'af al pi shebedinei Yisrael habal yoresh es ishto. According to halacha, a husband inherits his wife. So even though the woman died relatively shortly after the marriage took place, the husband would inherit. Kevan shahakol yodim shehem holchim bedinei hagoyim. Everyone there knows that these people followed non-Jewish law, again, whatever exactly that means. It's as if the two parties made an explicit stipulation that they would be following non-Jewish law. Similar to what, again, Rabbi Willig was discussing before, at the end that somebody asked the question. Ukumosha amru, like the Gemara says, gamle da'arvaya isha gova furna mehen lefisha someches aleim. There is a halacha that normally the only thing that is collectible for a debt is real estate, karka, land. However, the Gemara says that gamle da'arvaya, the camels in Arabia, a woman can collect her ksuva from the camels, can collect the debt, basically, there's a shibud, like there's a lien on these, because it's not, that is in Arabia, that is considered like land, because it's so common and it's used in currency. So since that is the understanding when the loan was created, so therefore you can collect that. So they want to argue the same thing over here, since the understanding of this marriage was that the nedunya should be given back. That's what they should follow. So the Rashba says absolutely not. And I'm skipping now. Just over MS Amru. Shemasnin Kenya Zava Linho Kane Mibne Shahu Mishpat Hagoyim the MS Nirali the Usur Lefi Shahu Mechakes Hagoyim Vizel Shazira Torah Lefneim Velo Lefnegoyim Vaaf Abisha Shneim Rotsim Bekach Vahu Dover Shabamamon Shaloini Chatora Saam Sholanachal Aloa Ratona. So the Rashba basically says that if two people make a stipulation on their own, that's one thing. But to do it just because that is the secular law, that would be basically just abandoning Torah law and following secular law. So the Rashba seems to be saying that even in certain cases where we could have mutual agreements between the parties, but nevertheless you can't just sort of follow secular law. Now exactly what the line is, and this is really the very fine line, of when we just say, well, the two parties accepted it on themselves, and that's what we should follow, or whether we're doing it because we're following non-Jewish law, that is very unclear. If you look at the second statement of the Rashba, where the Tshuva, Kasav Rashba v'Tshuva, Linyan Dina de Malchusa Dina Da, Shelo Amru Ela B'mai De'ika Hurmana de Malka, Ubedvarim Shehem Midine HaMalchus. He says, Dina de Malchusa only applies when there is like a law of the king, or the king has established this as some kind of law. Ki kamosha yesh lanu mishpatei melucha, kamosha amar Shmuel Yisrael, kach b'shar ha'umos, dinim yuduim yesh lamalchus, va'aleyam amru de dineyam din. If the king passes laws, if the government makes laws, just like Jewish kings can make laws, non-Jewish kings can make laws. Every society has to have laws, and those laws are binding on all the citizens. Aval, Dinim shedonim ba'arkaos, ein elu mimishpatei hamalucha, eloha arkaos, donim la'atzmam. Things that the court just do on their own, that's different. Now, what exactly does the Rashba mean by this? I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that you have, in secular law, this dichotomy between things that are a matter of statute, things that are passed and become law as a result of, let's say, legislative action. And then there's common law. There's just the way courts operate. Are there some lawyers here who could explain this perhaps a little? I know one or two. Yeah.
No, there's two types of common law. There's common law, which is application of statute. In other
words, right, how you...
filling in
right.
The facts. And it is, in some circumstances, there are concepts of law that are created independent of legislation.
Right.
Okay,
so I think that the Rashba would be referring to something like that. That if Congress passes a certain law, that's binding on all the citizens. But if it's just a matter that the courts practice, this is their interpretation of what the law should be, where it's not explicitly a legislative act, so that would already be something which would be, which we would not say, Dina de Malchus Adina, or something like that. Yes.
Third level.
Yeah.
Each court publishes its own rules.
Mm-hmm.
They're mostly rules of procedure, but they're indigenous to that court.
To that court. So that would not be in the category of Dina de Malchus Adina. That's what the Rashba seems to be saying. All right. So basically, the Rashba is limiting the application of Dina de Malchus Adina. The first case, again, it's a little bit unclear exactly how far, but what the Rashba is saying, that since Yerusha is a matter that is clearly prescribed by the Torah, how Yerusha works, we can't allow Dina de Malchusa to get involved in laws of Yerusha, just like clearly nobody is going to say that Dina de Malchusa Dina should get involved in Ben Adam HaMakom kinds of laws, right? If the government passes a law that, right, in the United States, right, January 1st is New Year's, we're not going to say that's Rosh Hashanah, because the government passes such a law, right? Clearly, in Ben Adam LaMakom, Dina de Malchus Adina has no role whatsoever. And so the Rashba is saying that in Choshen Mishpat also, Choshen Mishpat is halacha, and you basically follow Choshen Mishpat, unless the two sides specifically make some kind of an agreement amongst themselves that they are going to follow their own matters. Okay, now look at the second source over here. The Rivash seems to take a different position. The Rivash is Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes, and he was later than the Rashba. Again, the first one was the Beis Yosef. That's Rav Yosef Karo quoting the Rashba. This is the Rivash. He was the Rav in Algiers, and he was actually he was born in Spain, I think. He lived from 1326 to 1408, and so the Rivash says, "Masha Kosavta." This is in the middle of a long tshuva where he's discussing a complicated case, and part of it was that a person was sort of giving a, was arranging for for his estate, what would happen to it after he passed away, and he arranged that it should go to a certain person, and after that person it should go, when that person dies it should go to someone else. So sha'acharecha li'isha achar misa sabanos eino klum kevon shaharishon ro'i liyarsho the yerusha ein la hefsek. So he sort of arranged for his estate or part of his estate to go to a certain person. That person, I don't know whether it was his daughter, might have been his daughter, and when his daughter died, he wanted it to go to a different party. I don't know why the guy made that arrangement, but whatever it was. But his daughter had other children. His daughter had children. So according to Dinei HaTorah, if once you gave it to someone who was your legal heir, it remains theirs and you can't make any other stipulations. So it's going to remain with the daughter and it'll go to the daughter's children, etc., whoever the daughter's legal heirs are. So according to the halakha, we say Yerusha ein lehefsek. If it goes through inheritance, none of your stipulations are valid. So the Rivash says, Zehaya emes, this would be so, im hayana sebein hayehudim, if this was done amongst Jews, b'makom shedonim dineim b'dinei Yisrael, where they follow Jewish law. Aval hametzave hazeh, the person who made this will, hayadar b'mayorka, lived in the island of Mallorca, b'cheskas ovei kachavim, there most of them were Muranos, and they were following non-Jewish law. V'chein ha'isha haba lirash mikoach hatzava, kam hisham b'cheskas nachris. The woman who is collecting, who was involved over here, she also, the man who bequeathed it, and the woman who was the beneficiary, they were all like Moranos, b'cheskas nachrim, living like non-Jews. And then later on they came to Jewish Bezdin for somehow to adjudicate this. V'chein halalu avam lirosh machmas korva gam heim darim sham, all the other people involved in this were also darim sham b'cheskas nachrim v'gam b'yahadusam, even if they were as Jews, haya lahem ladun b'dinei ovdei kochavim, they should follow non-Jewish law, ki kein nahagu me'olam kahal Mallorca meretzonam, because that's what they always did in Mallorca. They followed non-Jewish law, so that's what they should follow. So how can they now go somewhere else? And I would say all of a sudden we want to follow Jewish law if the assumption was that they till now followed non-Jew. This is an unbelievable statement, isn't it? That's just, in other words, the Jewish law doesn't exist. They lived as Goyim, they followed Goyish law, so we're not going to judge them with Jewish law. Unbelievable statement of the Rivash. Now, if you turn the page, the Tashbates, that was Rav Shimshon ben Tzarach Duran, he actually was the Rivash's successor in Algiers. He became the Rav in Algiers after the demise of the Rivash, and he takes sharp issue with his predecessor on this matter. And he quotes it in the first part, Kosav b'kundresim. He's basically quoting this matter. And then the second, we don't have to read it because it's just basically just a rehash of what the Rivash said. But the second paragraph says, Ve'elu dvarim below raya. These are things, the Rivash just made this up. Right, there's no proof for this. The ein hadas of losan klal, it's not logical. Shahanechasim halalu kan nimtzu v'kan hayu umashahu b'rishus Yisrael chas v'shalom sheyotzi osam rishuso lavkiyaz chus Yisrael. Just if they're coming now to Jews and they're coming to a Bezdin, the Bezdin should follow Jewish law, should follow halacha in deciding. And he says even he said we would never allow them, if they asked us, we would never say go to a non-Jewish court. So now we should tell them they come to us, we should tell them go back to a non-Jewish court. It's absolutely, incredible. So basically he sharply disagrees with the Rivash. So it appears that you have the Rivash on one side taking what appears to be a rather extreme position, that you just, if the people are living as non-Jews, are following non-Jewish law, you ignore Torah law and you follow non-Jewish law. On the other hand, you have the Tashbates who disagrees, and the Rashba originally right, who also talks about a similar kind of inheritance matter, also appears to sharply disagree with this idea of the rivash. So the question is, lahalacha, what do we follow? So we find an astonishing thing that the Ramah in Choshen Mishpat quotes both views. In different places, he quotes both views. It's incredible, right? So if you look here, I have them both. We have the Shulchan Aruch, we have the Ramah in Reish Mem Ches, and the Ramah in Shin Samach Tes. I apologize, in the second one, I forgot to put the Ramah, my program didn't do it automatically, I didn't put the Ramah in italics, so it's hard to distinguish it from the text of the Shulchan Aruch, but we'll look at it in a moment. But first, let's look at the first one, in Reish Mem Ches, number four. And there I put the Ramah is in italics. So if you go, the case is the exact same case that the Rivash was discussing. Shriv Merash Amar, a person who's on his sickbed, who is dividing up his estate, and he says, Nechassai Leploni, my property should go to so-and-so, V'achrav Leploni, and after it to someone else. Ein L'sheni Elamashashia Rishon. The second one only gets what's left over from the first. V'im Haya HaRishon Ra'oi L'Yarsha. Right, if the first one is someone who's his legal heir according to the Torah, K'gon Shahaya Ben Michlal Habanim, Ein L'sheni Klum. Now the second one doesn't get anything, because as we mentioned, that was the principle that the Rivash was discussing, that the legal heir gets it. Now, if you skip down to the Ramah, not the first Ramah, but the second one where it says Haggah. It's just about in the middle of this piece, by the little letter Gimel in brackets. Haggah. V'im asa hatzava'a b'makom shenoagu lodun ba'arkos shel ovdei giglulim. Right, if the tzava was made in a country or in a place, a locale where they followed non-Jewish law, ubo acharkach lodun b'dinei Yisrael, and then they came to a Jewish court, lo amrina d'Yerusha ein lahefsek. We don't follow the Jewish law of Yerusha. And again, he's quoting the Rivash. So the Ramah seems to accept this Rivash. Okay. But on the other hand, in Shin Samach Tes, where there the Rivash says, let's see, I have to find it in this print. Yeah, it's where the letter Gimel is with the two marks before it and afterwards. I don't know what the like the greater sign and the less than sign. You see, v'chein hanose isha b'makom shadonin b'dinei ovdei kalchavim umesa ishto lo yuchal avi ishto ashar yosha lomar. If he married a woman in a place where they followed dinei akum, then his wife died. So now the father wants the nedunya back. He can't say kol hanose isha al das minag hu nose v'nidon hadavar b'dinei ovde kol chavim d'imesa yarsha baila. So here he's passing like the Rashba. V'lekam izem ishum dina de malchusa. And again, he quotes the Beis Yosef according to the Rashba. D'lo amrin on dina de malchusa ele b'davar sheyesh bo hana ala melech. The king again makes his laws. O Shahula Takanas B'nei HaMedina, but not all the laws of the courts. We don't follow the laws of the Imkain, but Lukal Dina Yisra. He quotes it quotes this end part from the Maharik, but it's all part of it's the same idea as the Rashba. So this appears to be quite an open contradiction in the Ramah as to whether he says we do follow the non-Jewish law when the general Jewish society seems to be following it, or not. Now, so many of the Achronim discuss this, and the Shach and the Sma, the Ktsos in Shulchan Aruch all talk about this, and I forget whether it's the Ktsos or the Sma. One of them says, look, the Ramah obviously didn't see the tshuva of the Tashbates. Had he seen that tshuva of the Tashbates, he never would have quoted the Rivash. Of course, it still doesn't explain, it doesn't answer the contradiction, but it just points out that the contradiction is there. The Chassam Sofer, however, I don't think did I put the Chassam Sofer on the page? I don't think you have to. I have the tshuva of the Chassam Sofer? I don't think I... No. Okay. The Chassam Sofer comes up with a possible solution. He first of all says he thinks the Tashbeis is correct, but he says still it's a pella on the Ramah. How could the Ramah even quote such a thing? So he suggests the following. He says, why is it that in the case of Yerusha, we say that if the person is the legal heir, then the property does not go, cannot be given to the next party, but it has to remain with the heirs of that heir? That's because we interpret, when the person said, I am giving my property to so-and-so, if the person is his legal heir, we assume that he just meant that I'm allowing that person to yarshin, I'm allowing that person to inherit. But if he wanted to, he could have specifically stipulated, I am giving it as a gift a moment before my death, with the stipulation that it should go to so-and-so at a later date. That a person has the right, even according to Dinei HaTorah, to do. So it is merely a matter of how we interpret. Normally, since this is a legal heir, we assume that the word give, quote-unquote, was being used in a more informal way, and it meant bequeath. It meant I'm allowing them to inherit. But if this person lives amongst non-Jews, then his manner of talking isn't going to be like that of quote-unquote a frum Jew who understands that with your legal heirs, when you say give, you mean bequeath. So we have to interpret his words, and legally, api halacha, you could do that. You can give a gift that should be chal before your death that will be subject to all kinds of stipulations. According to halacha, you have that right to do it. It's just that that's not normally the way we would interpret his words. But here, because of the fact that he lives amongst non-Jews, we interpret his words to mean that. And that would explain what the Rivash means, because otherwise the whole Rivash is incredible, and the Ramah quoting it is incredible. So it would turn out that if we accept this interpretation of the Chasam Sofer, there really is no contradiction between the Ramah, the two statements of the Ramah, and there's no disagreement necessarily between the Rivash and the Tshuva of the Rashba. Because the Rashba is saying that we can't allow Torah law to be usurped by secular law. That principle remains the same. However, what the Rivash is saying is that when it's a matter of understanding what a person had in mind, the only way to understand the person is by the context in which the person lives and functions. And if a person lives and functions in a non-Torah society, that's his or her way of thinking, and that's the way you have to understand it, and it's a question of interpreting their mind, that's the way you have to do it. Now this principle, whether or not one accepts this as the as a teretz in this case, and I think it does help to explain the Ramah, but there are many important applications of this that are contemporary applications, I would say, in Beis Din. And one of them I just xeroxed for you in the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein that you have on the other handout. It's the page you see in the top. It says Shin Mem Ches, Rav Moshe Feinstein. This came from a journal. I think it's from actually a strange Refuah v'Halacha, which this has nothing to do with Refuah, but somehow this article got stuck in there. And the paragraph that I draw your attention to is in the second on the left hand side, the first paragraph at the top. Uve etzem mistaber. Do you see it? Shagam me etzem hadin. Ramosha here is talking about bankruptcy and how bankruptcy law works with halacha, which is a very interesting topic in and of itself. But this one paragraph over here highlights, I think, the concept that we're developing over here. Uve etzem mistaber, shagam me etzem hadin, lo mishtabdin hakarkos, b'medinos sha'osim in yonei mechiras karkos, rak kedinehem, mishum sheshibud talui b'smichas das shal hamalveh. Ubavadai leko smichus das kesha'arkos hamedina lo yaskimu loze. So Rav Moshe is saying the following. We know that in halacha, we have a din known as shibud karka. If I lend someone money, and a shtar, a legal document is written that I'm lending that person money, so if that person cannot pay me back when the note is due, I am allowed to seize their land in payment for my debt. That's called shibud karkos, that there's a lien on the land. And that's automatic. There's no need even to write it in, although there's a machlokas in the Gemara about that, but we assume even if it's not written in the document, just by the fact that there is a document for this loan, I can collect the land. So Rav Moshe says that does not apply. He doesn't believe that that would apply, let's say, in America today. Why? Because legally, if I went to court, I could never do that. I can't seize somebody's house just because they owe me money, unless there was a mortgage on it, there's some kind of a lien that is attached. If the court attaches a lien, then when the house is sold, you can collect a certain, you can collect, but you can't just go and seize someone's land. The court, the government would never allow you to do that. So since it's not legally enforceable in court, says Rav Moshe, he doesn't think the whole thing applies al pi din anymore. Why? Because the whole idea of liens is smichus das, that a person, when they lend the money, so the lender knows that he'll be able to collect from this, and the debtor knows that he'll have to forfeit it. So it's understood between the two of them that this lien exists. But since in America it's not collectible in practical terms, no one even has that in mind. That's not part of the smichus das. When you lend money, that's not part of the person's mindset. And therefore, that halacha no longer applies. So again, I think that Rav Moshe is really using the same kind of reasoning, that we have to take the context of where the agreement is made into account in determining how the halacha is going to apply. Just like if two parties stipulate amongst themselves when they lend money between themselves that there should be no shibud karka, so there wouldn't be. So the assumption here is that there's no shibud karka because that's the way the mindset of people in America is to think. So Rav Moshe makes that point here in this tshuva. So I think that's very, very similar to the Chasam Sofer's understanding as well of the Rivash, that we have to look at the contemporary situation to understand what the mindset of the Balei Din are. So, no Beis Din, as far as I know, would ever issue a psak that if let's say there's someone owes someone money and they can't pay, no one is going to say go take his house. Even though al pi halacha you could say, well, there's a shibud karka, you owe the money, give up your house. Nobody is going to paskin that way because since in Dina de Malchusa, it doesn't work that way. We assume, like Rav Moshe says, that there's no smichus das, and nobody ever had that in mind when they made the loan, and therefore it's not collectible even in halacha. So that a Beis Din paskening is in effect, therefore, taking the Dina de Malchusa into account in its psak. Other examples of this. Again, Rav Moshe has a tshuva, which is actually, this is really veering into Yoredeya, but it's a similar idea that well-known tshuva of Rav Moshe, that if you lend money to a corporation, there is no isur on charging interest, even if the corporation is fully owned by Jews. Right, and the Jewish people, you're basically in effect lending Jews money, but since it's a corporation, so there's no isur in charging interest. Why? Because Rav Moshe says, look, since according to the law, you cannot collect personally from any of the people, right? There's a corporate veil, right, when it's incorporated, and you can only collect from the assets of the corporation, but you can't collect privately. That's the whole idea of a corporation, right? It protects the principals from any personal liability. So therefore, that's not a real halva in the way the Torah described it. And therefore, the Isur of Ribus is only when you lend somebody money and they have a shibud aguf, they have a personal obligation to pay you back. When their obligation is purely as a member of a corporation, they have no personal obligation to pay you back whatsoever, and therefore that's not a halva. So there's no isur of taking ribas. So Rav Moshe there is taking it and moving it into Yoredeya matters. That's really in a sense beyond ours. But I'm only mentioning this because this also comes up in Beis Din sometimes when one of the litigants comes and appears not personally, but as a representative of a company, or as the owner of a company. Let's say the owner of a corporation, right, there's a din Torah between two people, let's say an employer and an employee, and the employer, the employee is claiming whatever it is, a salary that wasn't paid or other things that are owed to him, and the employer, let's say it turns out that the employee really is owed the money, but the employer says, look, the company is bankrupt, or there's no money left, and that's it, so I can't pay. So Will the Beis Din say, now look, Al Pi Din, if I hire someone to work for me, so it doesn't matter whether the company that they work for is out of business. If I hire them, I owe them the money, right? So if we were strictly following Dinei HaTorah and a Torah kind of society, we would say, all right, so your company is out of business, but you hire the guy. Pay him from your own assets. Pay him from the money you have in your bank, your personal funds. But since if he came to, if when he was hired, the person was hired not by this man as a private employer, but as the president of ABC Corporation, so therefore the understanding is that it's only the ABC Corporation that has to pay the person. So again, the Beis Din is going to respect secular law in this regard, and not make the employer pay out of his or her private finances and pocket, because that wasn't the understanding when the employee was hired. So again, this is another application how this will apply in a Beis Din setting. Yes.
Sometimes in a situation where you're dealing with a corporation, ultimately when a court looks into it, they decide corporation's a sham. You have to look through the corporation and go to the owner. In that situation, the person lends and follows the corporation. So, if I'm doing it right, is he allowed to collect?
Why would the court say that a corporation is a sham?
It's called looking through the corporate veil. It was run and set up in such a way that it was effectively always the individuals, never the corporation acting.
So I suppose that if it really is a sham, the only thing is a Beis Din may not have the ability to know that.
But I'm saying that is the, because now Reuven, who lent in all good faith, thinking he was lending to the corporation, perfectly legitimate.
You mean in the case of Ribis?
Right. See, that one.
If he never expected to get the money back from the person directly, probably it goes by what he was thinking, I imagine. But that's an interesting case. What about a case of corporation that turned out not to be corporations, right? Do you go by, but when they were doing it, they thought they were dealing with corporations, so maybe then we say that still is their mindset. It could very well be. I don't know. It's a good question. Very, very good question. The Gemara in Gittin talks about shtaros ha'olin ba'arkos shel akum, that various legal documents that were made in a non-Jewish court, and there are two opinions of the Gemara in Gittin as to whether what the Gemara means there when it says that shtaros ha'olin ba'arkos shel akum are ksherim, are good, even, and they're signed by non-Jews as witnesses, etc. So the Gemara says, "Chutz migitei nashim." Obviously, a get, right, which is a religious kind of a document. You can't have a get that's signed by non-Jewish edim. That clearly is no good. So the Gemara says, "Yeah, but what about any other kind of a shtar kinyan? If according to the halacha, in order for a shtar to be good, it has to be signed by kosher edim. How can the Mishnah say that a shtar that's signed by non-Jewish edim is going to be good?" So the Gemara has two terutzim. One terrace, the Gemara says, is chutz mikigitei nashim. When the Mishnah says excluding gittin, it doesn't only mean gittin. It means gittin and any other kind of a shtar that really accomplishes something. The only kind of non-Jewish shtaros we would accept are shtaros that are like testimony, IOU notes or the like, but not a shtar kinyan, not a shtar that creates any kind of transfer of property. And the other day, and the Gemara says, no, that we would accept those shtaros because dina de malchus adina. That falls under the rubric of Dina de Malchus Adina. And there's a great deal of discussion in the amongst the Rishonim and Achronim as to how exactly that would work. So how is Dina de Malchus Adina going to get involved? So if the government has a law that this kind of a kinyan works, but according to Halacha it doesn't work, so what is the mechanism that makes it work according to Halacha? How would Dina de Malchus Adina play a role in that case? Because as we said, normally Dina de Malchus Adina is a kind of a thing that between two Jews, like the Rashba says, we're not going to use their laws to interfere in our own workings. So, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, in his commentary to the Rambam, the name, I'm having a moment for a minute. But what's his sefer called? Anybody remember? It'll come to me in a minute, probably. He comes up with the following very interesting idea. And he says, look, we have in halacha the concept of situmta. Situmta means a kinyan that is not a Torah kinyan, but if it is normal in that business, so we view that as a kinyan. The Rav always, when he gave shir, used to give as an example in the diamond industry, so the two parties shake hands and they say mazel u'bracha. And that's once you've said that, you can't back out. That's an example of a situmta, that two parties are doing what is accepted as the normal commercial practice in their industry. That has validity according to halacha. So Rav Issa Zalman suggests that that's what the Gemara means when it says that the Dina de Malchusa makes a kinyan work. It's not that we follow the Dina de Malchusa, that since the secular law recognizes this, so halacha is bound by secular law. No, that since in this country, secular law has decreed, the government has decreed that this is the way you make a kinyan, so all the Jews are going to do that also. And if all the Jews are doing it, so it becomes a situmta. It becomes something that again is accepted by the Jews. So here again is another application of the same idea that the secular law can determine sort of what the minhag is going to be for Jews in an area where minhag is important. And in general, minhag hamadina plays a very, very important role in Choshen Mishpat, because at the beginning of Hasocher es hapolim, so the Gemara quotes the idea of hakol, the Mishnah says it, and the Gemara elaborates, hakol kaminhag hamadina. This is in fact where the Yerushalmi makes the statement that is sort of misquoted. The Yerushalmi says over there, Zos omeres minhag mevatel halacha. And the Yerushalmi means to say that if there's a certain minhag hamakom in a certain place in financial matters, so we follow that against the halacha. So for example, even though according to the halacha, the time of employment, strictly according to Torah law, if you hire someone for a job, they have to come and appear to work at sunrise, and they go home at night. But if the minhag hamakom is 9 to 5, so you follow minhag hamakom. So the Yerushalmi says, Zos omeres minhag mevatel halacha. Yerushalmi doesn't mean that in Iser v'heter, if I can have a minhag to eat something treif, you know, the minhag mevatel halacha. It means that when you're dealing with monetary matters, the parties can consent to things other than what the halacha says. And if there's a certain minhag in a community that way, we assume that this is what the parties are doing. So obviously, if we are deciding matters, we are going to follow what the normal practice is in that industry. Or if there's a government law about something, let's say, you know, in employment matters. So, you know, if there are laws about how long employees are supposed to work in a certain field, you know, they're not supposed to work more than X number of hours a day, or they're entitled to X number of breaks, or whatever it is, all of that is going to be relevant based on the idea of minhag hamakom. And we can accept these minhagei hamakom even in areas where they go against what the Gemara might say or what the halacha might suggest. We not long ago had a case in the Beis Din. Again, this was sort of what Rabbi Willig, somebody asked the question, started to speak about, where there was a case of a contractor and was building a house with someone, and they were having disputes about matters. And it said in their contract that you know, any disputes between the contractor and the customer will be decided by an arbitration panel following New Jersey law, you know, according to the principles of New Jersey law. Now, it came to the Beis Din because they both agreed to come to Beis Din. So here the question is now. And the issue was there was a certain vagueness in the contract. Now, according to halacha, when you have a vagueness in a contract, we say, Hamotzi mechaver olav haraya, that the one who's muchzak, the person who was in possession of the money, it keeps it unless we can prove that the other one owes it, right? So if there's a vagueness in the contract, it will go against the generally the plaintiff and in favor of the defendant, because the defendant has it and we're trying to be motzi. You can't be motzi if you have no proof, if there's a vagueness in the contract. However, according to secular law, I think in most places, the contract is understood to be against the party who drafted it. So if one side wrote the contract, any vaguenesses are interpreted to the detriment of the side that wrote it. So if the side that wrote it is the muchzak, So then it turns out that halacha and the secular law are saying the same thing. But if the person who wrote it was the motzi, so then secular law would say it goes in favor. The one who wrote it is the muchzik; it goes against the muchzik, and according to the halacha, it goes in favor of the muchzik. So then you're stuck. So we were in a little bit of a quandary, because on the one hand, according to dinei haTorah, we felt that the muchzik should win. On the other hand, but we were the whole arbitration was based on the fact that we had to follow New Jersey law. So in that case, we would have ended up following New Jersey law. However, luckily, the Dayanim all felt that the contract was not that vague, that the indication was in favor of the Muchzik. So it turned out that we were able to, we didn't have to have that contradiction. But again, you can end up having that and you'll have to follow the secular law, even though according to halacha, because that's what the parties bound themselves by, and that's what they... Now, whether they should have done that or not, as Rabbi Willie was speaking before, maybe they probably should not have done that. But I suspect that it was probably almost like a boilerplate contract that they probably signed. Yes?
So what does the Bezit do in the following situation? Let's say people... It sounds like there's no stigma for people to agree to use the secular law as long as they're coming from the Bezit, right?
There's no
stigma for people to say, well, okay, we'll use... But first, let's say they're engaging in a business deal. Obviously, in the world of bankruptcy, which means that the laws are well-developed and we're familiar with it. So they say, well, we're using bankruptcy law, etc., New Jersey law. Now they have a dispute, and they come for a Bezit. Some of these areas, law, tax law, bankruptcy law, extremely complicated.
Right.
Require people with great expertise.
Right, so the Bezin isn't going to have the expertise in this field. So what the Bezin would probably have to do is they would have to take Rabbanim who are lawyers and who have competency in this area. Of competence in this area. You're right, a regular Rav is going to say, look, I'm qualified to decide Choshen Mishpat, not qualified to examine the tax laws of, or the bankruptcy laws of New York and figure that out. And you'd probably have to take Dayanim who are lawyers.
You're going to need people with real experience.
And they would probably have to consult expert opinions. They'd probably have to get expert opinions. If they end up being Rabbanim, they'd have to, the Bezdin would have to hire an expert. And you just like if a complicated medical matter came before them, they'd have to hire a doctor. But you see, it works differently. In Bezin, let's say a regular trial, so each side brings their own experts. And generally in a Bezin, you're more likely to have the Bezin is going to hire the expert because they don't want the expert to be biased. And otherwise, you just end up with each side buys their own expert, and then the Bezin still has to decide. So the Bezin would probably just hire their own expert and say, we don't want either of you to bring experts. We'll get the expert. And, they'll hire somebody neutral and probably listen and get the opinion that way. That's generally what would be done. Luckily, the Menahel of the Bezin is a lawyer. So in most cases, it happens all the time. We as Dayanim will turn to the Menahel and say, look, what does secular law say about this point? It's relevant to our, and he'll generally be able to advise us. But obviously, it would be very complicated. You'd have to hire an expert in that field.
Does the Bezdin of America require, as a condition of using the Bezdin, coming to the Bezdin, that any award in favor of one party can be enforced by secular law, i.e. confirm an arbitration award and translate it into a judgment under secular law?
Yes. Whenever there's a Din Torah, they sign an arbitration agreement, and that arbitration agreement states in it clearly that this can be enforced by court, whatever the legal way is that it's done. Yes, because otherwise we're wasting our time. We're going to spend all this time deciding this, and then one party doesn't like the decision. They're going to say, sorry. Now, of course, if you don't sign arbitration, it's always signed in advance. Yeah, they must sign arbitration agreement. Okay. Now, there's another area where Bezdin is going to take secular law into account. And this you have on the other side of the page with Rav Moshe on this. This was written by Rav Henkin. Now, Rav Henkin in many ways was really, I would say, quote unquote, was an American posek. Rav Henkin came to America in the 20s. And really understood American. So if you read his writings, you see they had quite an insight into American society. And he comes up with a few very interesting points. And he explains that if you have a strong Jewish community, part of what a Jewish community has to do is govern themselves. And they have to have rules and regulations for how they have to make takanos about things. They have to govern themselves properly and in a just fashion. He says that in Bayes, over here. Bizmanu v'makom sheYisrael mekubatzim yachad v'hem shomrei Torah. Aleihem lios mitzuyanim va'agudim v'kehila miyuchedes. They have to have a community. Afilu k'shem kavushim begola tachas umos ha'olam. Begoy b'karagva. Even when they're in a non-Jewish land, they still aleihem lemanos dayanim v'tuvei ha'ir. They have to have dayanim. They have to have people in charge. Sheyifkuchu b'takanos ha'kehila. Hein b'inyanei Torah. Hein b'derech eretz. In all areas, ben adam lamakam. And he explains that there used to be meetings at the marketplaces. The Rabbanim would get together, and like, you know, they had the Vat Arba Arotzos in Eastern Europe, very, very famous. So now, but now he comes up and he says, look at Dalet. Bizman uvamakom she'en li Yisrael batei dinin kavuin v'tuvei ha'ir. Where the Jews do not have their own self-government. V'hamemshala chokekes chukim l'tovas ha'am. But the government makes laws. B'dvarim shebamamon shetluyim b'minhagei ha'medina hakol chayovim linog b'dinei ha'memshala. So he says, like we were saying, in minhagei minhag ha'makom, that becomes the minhag ha'makom. Since the Jews don't have their own independent minhag ha'makom, the general minhag ha'makom becomes theirs. That's again very similar to what the Rivash was saying. If you're living in a non-Jewish society, their minhag ha'makom is your minhag ha'makom. And ukesheyavo hadavar l'dayone Yisrael, when it will come even to a bezdin, daininan b'dinei hamemshala, you're going to follow these laws of the court. V'kocham kekoach minhagei hamedina b'Yisrael. And they have the same strength, the same, and he says now, ubifrat b'medina constitutionalist, right? Shahachukim na'asim al yidei nifchorei ha'am. It's done democratically. Hayehudim b'sochem, the Jews also voted for these, for the people who are representing them. The kinyonim hamo'ilim al pitakanoseim, whatever kinyonim work, that's what we said before. Dinan kedim tzitumta. This is like Rabbi Zalman Meltzer the same thing. And he continues in Ches a little more about this. Anachnu yoshvei artzos habrista America, shechukeha naasim al yidei hanivcharim mikol ha'ezrachim. Right, that the laws are made by the Congress. That if they're made for you know, for the good of the people, so the same thing he says, that this would be dina de malchus adina. I'm skipping a few lines in there. Afshal lefamim ein zal pi ha'shulchan aruch. It still may not be according to the shulchan aruch. And then he goes on. He was discussing over here very interesting rent control laws. So let's say, you know, the government, New York, right, has rent, very strict rent control laws, right? All the landlords hate it, and the tenants love it, right? So a case comes to Beis Din, and the landlord says, look, you know, we're Jews, both of us, again, from landlord, from tenants. And the landlord said, look, why do I have to, I want to charge a much more rent. Apidin, you know, this was not made by, it doesn't say Shulchan Aruch, that you have to have a rent control, so I want to charge more money. I think I'm entitled to more. The market value of this apartment is greater. I want to charge more. It's a case, whatever, maybe the contract was vague or something, and he wants to. So the Bezdin would probably say, look, you know, if this is the din of the Malchusa, if this is the law of the land, you can't charge any more money. And not necessarily because of what we were saying before, because that was the assumption, but because this law was made for the good of the of society. Again, whether there should or shouldn't be rent control is an issue for the government to decide. But if they decided they should have it, so then we're all bound by it, even though it may not be according to Dinei HaTorah. And so a court would take into account these things. The same is true with zoning laws, right? Zoning laws are not made by us, but nevertheless, zoning laws are the kind of thing that if, so let's say two parties would come for a Din Torah, one claims the other guy, he's building too far out on his property, it's blocking his light. Now in Bava Basra, we have all kinds of zoning laws that are Torah zoning laws, but nobody here, the Jews never made any kind of laws. So the other side will say, look, you know, why am I bound by the, we're in Beis Din, why am I bound by the secular law? Most probably the Beis Din would rule that you are bound by this, because this is, again, these are laws that are made by common consent, l'tovas ha'medina. Since we as Jews don't have an independent minhag, we are bound by the general minhag of minhag ha'makom in all of these things. And the same thing would go, many of the Dinei Torah that come before the Bezdin of America have to do with contractors and you know, customers. People are never satisfied with their contractors, right? So they bring them to Dinei Torah. So let's say a contractor did something against the building code. Right? He didn't fulfill the building code, but you know, it doesn't say in Shulchan Aruch anywhere that you have to follow building codes. He built him a house. So most probably, Bezdin would rule that you have to follow the building codes, and this is really for two reasons. First of all, one, because the laws of building, that's done the Tovas HaMedina, right? The government wants to have houses, wants people to have houses that aren't going to collapse on them, that are going to be strong and good and will last. So the building codes are made for good reason. So they would bind us as Minag HaMakom, that is the Minag. But secondly, also, that clearly would be the understanding of the parties. When you hire a contractor in America, you understand that contractor is going to build according to the codes. That's what they're supposed to do. Right? So that's also, so it falls under both. This kind of a thing would probably fall under both. One, it's Minag HaMakom, and two, it's the understanding of the parties. The Minag HaMakom creates such an understanding of the parties that you're going to build a house according to the codes of the country. Yes.
Does that also apply to the issue of what remedy the Bezdin will give? Because in this country, under Dinah D'Maplis Adina, we often have a concept that in certain cases you may not be entitled to consequential damages, in certain cases you may be, or you may not be able to get specific performance by the individual and may only have a right to damage.
That may be already under the realm of the Rashba, who says that we don't follow necessarily what goes on in court. So again, I'm not familiar enough with what could you give me a specific example?
Well, even in some cases, if you take a contract to court, the court may not require the contractor to finish the work. They may simply award you damages equal to the cost of having you getting someone else to finish.
Oh yeah, the halacha may do that too. That's definitely something in halacha. You have that concept. Yeah, you can't really force a person to do work, but you can make them pay. So if he doesn't want to do the work, they'll say, all right, so reimburse that amount of money that it's going to cost him. Question is, then you get involved. See, one of the main areas where there's a difference between secular law and halacha has to do with grama and causing loss where you didn't actually be a dayim. The halacha has a much more restricted view on what you can collect for. This is one area where I don't think Dina de Malchusa has that much application. So that according to halacha, if you just indirectly cause someone damage, you're not as liable as you are in secular law. But nevertheless, most batei din will in that case use kind of pshara, because you know we have one other thing that batei din have. Generally today, most batei din don't decide on strict halacha. We decide what's called pshara krova ledin. We figure out what the din should be, but we allow some room for give and take. So a lot of times things like that come under the rubric of pshara, where the bezin has a little bit of flexibility to allow things that maybe strictly according to the din they couldn't. If they really feel that someone was egregious in causing someone else damage, even though technically according to the halacha you may not be able to collect, but if they really feel that an avla was done, they may, based on pshara, obligate the person to pay. Any one or two more questions I'll take. Otherwise, I think we'll next session is supposed to start at 11:30, right? So I think we better stop. Better stop here. Okay. Now that we're finished, I remember the Rav Issa Zalman Sefer is called the Evan Ha'ozel. Now it came to me. Okay.
I think today courts are not the way to watch. What type of courts are not?